KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
The man who torched a Vallejo wine warehouse has been sentenced to 27 years in prison.
Next on Forum, a decade ago, 4.5 million bottles of wine valued at $250 million went up in flames at a Vallejo warehouse. The fire was the desperate act of a respected wine collector trying to erase all traces of his years defrauding the wine lovers who trusted him. Among the destroyed collection were 175 bottles of a rare 19th century wine made by the ancestors of journalist Frances Dinkelspiel. In her new book, Tangled Vines, Dinkelspiel exposes the dark history of California's wine industry from arson to enslavement and even murder. And she joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Bay Area resident Frances Dinkelspiel joins us in studio for this Forum Hour to discuss her recently published book, Tangled Vines, Greed, Murder, Obsession, and an Arsonist in the Vineyards of California. The book takes us into some of the darker recesses of California's wine industry history, such as the use of virtual slave labor of Native Americans in the mid-19th century and the catastrophic arson in 2005 of a Vallejo storage facility, which destroyed some 4.5 million bottles of wine, estimated to be worth $250 million. An award-winning journalist and author of Towers of Gold, which we featured on Forum. Frances Dinkelspiel is co-founder of the news website Berkeley Side, and she's published in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, and San Francisco Magazine, and we welcome her to the second hour. Good to have you back on Forum, Frances.
Thanks, Michael, for having me.
Actually, last time you were here, Warren Hellman, your cousin, was with you and playing the banjo, and that was a sweet, memorable time that we had. This book, not so sweet, but certainly memorable. I mean, I was thinking about how people are reading it up in Napa, particularly since this is a pretty dark history that you go into. There are kind of three books in one. There's the history of the wine industry, a lot of it beginning in Southern California. There's your own personal involvement. And then there's the story of this Mark Anderson. I don't even know how to label the guy. What a piece of work. We'll get into each of them. But let's talk first about go back to like the 1850s, and there was essentially virtual widespread use of Native Americans for slave labor. That's how the wine industry began to burgeon and grow, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was something I found very surprising in doing my research. Many people know the story of the mission system, Father Junipero Serra creating these missions up and down the state and inviting Native Americans to come in and be baptized. And they became part of the mission system, and they couldn't leave. And, you know, their treatment was not great under the Franciscan fathers. But fewer people know that the Americans treated the Native Americans even worse than the Franciscans. In 1850, before California even was a state, it was just about to become a state, the legislature, in its very first official act, passed a law that was called the Indian Indenture Act. That was its nickname. And it essentially stripped Native Americans of a lot of their rights. They weren't allowed to vote anymore. They couldn't testify against white men. But it also allowed white men to take the Indians' labor. All they had to do was identify a Native American as intoxicated or not working, and that would give a sheriff permission to arrest that Native American.
Then they become slave labor. Basically.
They would sell off their labor to the highest bidder.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's so unconscionable to think back on this. But then we get into how the wine industry really became more and more of a fact of life and an extraordinary fact of life here in California. You take us to Rancho Cucamonga, for example. You take us to your great-grandfather once again, for those who read Towers of Gold, and his involvement in the wine industry, Isaiah Hellman, right?
Isaias.
I always forget that S. But I say your name right. I remember the last time you were, I said Spiel, like it was instead of Spiel. Take us there for a moment, because this story we're going to get to about this arson, which many Californians, especially Northern Californians, remember, you had some of your great-grandfather's fine stock in there.
It certainly did. 175 bottles of Port in Angelica.
From back in 1870?
1875, the wine was made. So, few people don't know that Southern California was the center of the wine industry, probably up until 1890. You know, the first grapes planted by the missionaries were down there. And, you know, the land was fertile. There was enough water in L.A. It actually became known as the City of Vines. And people were looking for ways to make money. And when the, you know, all the gold miners rushed into the state, all of a sudden grapes started to go for $200. You know, they could make $200 an acre growing grapes. So there was this huge boom in planting vineyards and grapes throughout Southern California and parts of Northern California. And my great-great-grandfather in 1875 acquired a large parcel of land in Rancho Cucamonga at a sheriff sale. Essentially, the previous owner had not been able to pay her debts. And he took over this land. He subdivided it, but he kept the vineyard, which had been a very storied vineyard since 1839, and he improved it, and he and wine was made in 1875 that for some very, very strange reason was never sold. And it was sort of stored in a warehouse down in Rancho Cucamonga, and it wasn't really discovered until 1921 during Prohibition, when it was bottled then and distributed to various family members. And it was some of this wine that was in the warehouse that burned up.
And in fact, you got to sample it. We'll get to that. This was 140-year-old wine, which is quite an experience for you, I know, in itself, the aphrodisiacal aroma of that wine, as you call it. But I do want to get to the Mark Anderson story. But before we go there, I mean, the title of your book, Tangled Vines, Greed, Murder, Obsession, and an Arsonist in the Vineyards of California. The arsonist comes last, but there's a lot of greed, murder, and obsession before that, and a lot of blood and violence. In fact, let me just get the story of John Raines to you, which is another murder story.
Yeah, it's really amazing the amount of violence that is in the old history of the wine business. Yeah, so John Raines was a man who owned this vineyard that my great-great-grandfather eventually bought. And he was a Confederate sympathizer who had married the daughter of a rich don and used all her funds to buy the Rancho Cucamonga. And he sort of was a man living above his means. He was very land rich, but cash poor. And he borrowed a lot of money and put up his land as collateral. And people started to get jealous of John Raines. And one night in 1862, he hitched up his horses to drive to Los Angeles, which was about 40 miles away, and he never made it. And, you know, calls went out to find out what happened to John Raines. Posses were raised, and it took 11 days before his body was discovered. And he had been lassoed and pulled from his wagon, shot four times, and lay to sort of decay by the side of the road. And what happened as a result of his killing was sort of it flamed the fans of racism that were already under the surface in Southern California, because California for so long had belonged to first the Spanish, then the Mexicans, and the Californios, who were of Mexican descent, had ruled the land. But then all the Yankees came in and the Americans came in and took over California, and there was a lot of tension between them. And so Raines' murder sort of kicked off a lot of name-calling, vigilante activism, and that kind of thing. And it was this very dark episode in Southern California's history.
What you realize in reading your book is the wine history is sort of California's history. The two are integral and really tied together. But let's go up to Vallejo and that storage facility. I mean, this is the real there's a lot of page-turner stories in this book, but this is a book that's captured a lot of attention because it's most recent and many people remember. There was a Mare Island wine warehouse that was run by a guy named Mark Anderson, who was a bit of a bon vivant, kind of uber narcissist, and what a piece of work. And he was holding people were trusting him with all these fancy wines and expensive wines and so forth, and he was defrauding them and essentially selling them and whatnot. So the whole place is put up into fire. I mean, for essentially reasons of not wanting to be discovered.
That's right. So I write a lot about Mark Anderson, who was a man who was born in Berkeley, California, grew up in this very nice middle class home, was a hippie. He built houseboats in Sausalito. He sort of was a wanderer throughout his life. He got like 9 different degrees, but he never really settled into a profession was a good profession. He lived in Sausalito. He was on the Chamber of Commerce board. He was a member of various civic commissions.
He even had a plaque at Sushi Ran, right?
Exactly. Yeah. He visited this restaurant Sushi Ran so often that he won a place on the wall of the Sushi Lovers Hall of Fame. But for Mark Anderson, and this is one of the things I try to explore in Tangled Vines, wine was a determining factor for him. He really got a lot of satisfaction out of drinking wine, talking about wine, and I think he felt that his association with wine made him a more important person than he might otherwise have been considered. And this is what led to his downfall. He started a business storing people's wine in Sausalito, and he got lots of fancy wine, lots of restaurants gave their wine, lots of societies gave their wine. But Mark soon figured out that there was, you know, a better way to make money than just charging rent for this wine. It was much, much more lucrative to sell his clients' wine.
And he sold some pretty extraordinary wine. Some of the best and oldest wines literally went up in flames in the fire that he started. And I want you to talk a bit about the impact. I mean, we're not only talking about vintners and maybe by some people's lights, wine snobs here. We're talking about families that were really hurt. And it's been pointed out by a number of people that you talked to.
That's right. So the fire in 2005 destroyed 4.5 million bottles of wine worth about $250 million. And there was wine from 90 separate wineries in that warehouse, as well as 40 separate collectors. And, you know, a lot of people just think that, wine, you know, only rich people like wine. What do we care? That's not important. But in fact, a lot of the winemakers whose wine was destroyed were, you know, small family operations living from season to season. And, you know, they had all their capital in that vintage that burned up. And all of a sudden, they were left with nothing left to sell. Or some of them had already taken money from restaurants and stores, and they had to return that money. And so it was a very, very difficult period. And I talk in the book about Ted Hall, who is the owner of Long Meadow Ranch. And Ted and his wife had bought this beautiful old historic property near St. Helena, and he had 19 people working for him. And after he lost all his vintages that he had worked, you know, years to produce, he was left without anything to sell. And he didn't want to fire his employees, so he decided to make some grappa to sell, and he decided to make some white wine to sell. And a lot of the vintners who were affected by this fire had to do similar things. They had to scramble to bring in money. One vintner even made barbecue sauce out of her burnt up wine. So it really did affect a lot of small vintners, although, of course, a lot of corporations also were affected.
And you got to talk to Mark Anderson? You had a correspondence with him first, you know?
I did. So I started to do this story because I was writing a piece for the New York Times about his trial. And I was sitting at my desk one day when the phone rang, and I picked it up, and there was this automated voice on the other end asking if I would accept a collect call from Sacramento County Jail. And I said, of course. And imagine my surprise. On the other end of the line was Mark Anderson, who told me that he'd heard I'd been looking for him. Now, I don't know how Mark heard I'd been looking for him, but of course I wasn't going to refuse that call. And we had a brief conversation, which sort of started a lengthy relationship that went on for a couple years, where we talked on the phone a lot. We wrote one another letters, and I visited him in jail. And I sort of slowly was trying to get him to tell the story of his life, why he loved wine, and why he set this fire.
And why he defrauded people. I mean, essentially, these were people who trusted him, people who he built up rapport with, and he obviously had certain charms and charisma about him that was able to bring people in like a magnet, but he'd take their wine and sell it on what essentially was a black market.
That's right. So Mark would take his clients' wine, and he would go to a local wine store, like there were two in the Bay Area, Golden West and Premier Cru, and he would tell these people that he wanted to sell some of his own wine. And 10 years ago, you know, nobody double checked. You didn't have to prove the provenance of a wine you had to sell. So when he would go to these stores with his wine, they would take it on consignment and sell it online. And so he was able to sell about $1 million worth of his clients' wine this way. And in fact, you know, it sort of just revealed this weak spot in, you know, prosecution of wine and in the United States. The feds very closely regulate who can sell wine and how it's sold on the primary market. But the secondary market is much less regulated. And that's where wine fraud and wine crime has really exploded.
Yeah. In fact, let's talk a bit about wine fraud. But before we do that, we should mention he got 27 years in prison.
He did get 27 years in prison. And, you know, Mark was his own worst enemy. He had pleaded guilty in 2009, and then he withdrew his plea. And when he was finally sentenced in 2012, the judge was so mad at him that instead of giving him 15 years, he got 27 years. And he's now at Terminal Island, a prison in Southern California.
You know, like a lot of these criminals, he always thought he was smarter than everybody. To this day, he thinks he's going to beat the rap somehow, doesn't he?
He sure does. He thinks he's now he appealed his conviction. A court of appeals turned it down, and now he's asking the Supreme Court to overturn his conviction.
So what about, I mean, I remember, as many listeners do, the French Laundry was robbed from just a couple years ago this Christmas, I believe, of a pretty big stash of wine. A lot of it was recovered, I should say. But the fact of the matter is that wine has become, you know, sort of like paintings or something. People are stealing it and there's fraud going on and fake winery. What are the wine? I mean, you've done a lot of investigation of this. What are they doing up there in Napa and Sonoma?
Well, you're completely right. Like, the rise of wine fraud and crime is growing, and that's because the internet makes it so easy to sell stolen goods. And so, you know, there are a lot of cases of people working in wine storage facilities who steal wine and then sell it. In the case of the French Laundry, someone broke in last Christmas, the day after they closed for a 6-month remodel. They went straight to the wine cellar. They took only the best French wines, and they apparently sold it to a collector in the southern part of the United States. And a lot of people presume that was like a theft for hire, that somebody said, I want X, Y, and Z wines, and someone went out and got them. So there's this kind of fraud going on.
So what are the high-priced winemakers doing? What do they need to do to insure against that kind of fraud?
Well, the producers of the best wines in the world are taking some steps, and some of them have been effective. They're now creating labels that have holograms in them, have special markings that make it very, very hard to reproduce. They are putting special serial numbers on their corks in order to, make it hard to just put in a cork. They're doing a lot of these things, but these are wines that sell for thousands and thousands of dollars a bottle. They're not the kinds of wines that you or I will probably ever even taste, let alone purchase.
So, $2 Chuck would be more in my category.
Well, I hope you will aim a little higher than $2 Chuck. There's so many great vintners out
Actually,
there.
I went to a wine tasting event once where they had blindfolded people. You know, they had them taste all these different wines, some of them pretty expensive wines, and they also had $2 Chuck. And guess what? A lot of people put that high up against some of the competitive wines, which were really fine wines.
Well, an interesting side note, Fred Franzia, who is the maker of $2 Chuck, he was convicted in the 1980s of fraud because at that time there was a huge demand for white Zin. I don't know if you remember that. Well, I guess it's still around, the pink blush wine that's sort of sweet. And there weren't enough grapes to go around, and they commanded a lot of money. So Franzia and Bronco Winery, they picked some grapes that were not Zinfandel grapes, but sold them as Zinfandel grapes. And he was forced to plead guilty to that. And he was barred from the profession for a number of years. But now he's back, and, you know, his Bronco company is one of the largest wine companies in the world.
Well, you read your book and you realize there's a lot of corruption, greed, transgression of the law. There's a kind of legacy there. I don't know. How has this book been received up in Napa and wine country in general?
Well, there's
a lot of monstrous behavior you're writing about
right.
here. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's been received pretty well, in part because it tells a story that affected so many people in Napa. I mean, I tell the story of three separate winemakers who were affected by the fire and what they did to recover from the fire. So that speaks to their experience, and I think people appreciate that. You know, also, this book focuses a lot on the 19th and early 20th century, and looking at the sort of underbelly of the wine world at that era. And I don't don't really talk about, you know, the 21st century. So I think it's people up there aren't feeling personally attacked by what I reveal in the book.
There's a lot of, kind of trials of Job almost to the wine industry, too. I mean, now with drought, of course, but also the fires that have been endured up there and the theft. All of these kinds of things. And it makes you realize, I think you realize reading your book, how ephemeral wine is. But you also emphasize really the good spirits of spirits. I mean, the camaraderie, the bond, the feeling around the table that wine provides, and just the sense of elevation of human communication.
Well, I think this is one of the really interesting questions. Why do we like wine so much? Why is wine like a beverage that stands above other beverages? Why isn't milk exalted like wine? And I think it's a question that has interested humans since time immemorial. Look, the Greeks and the Romans had wine gods. You know, the Bible says the first thing that Noah did after the flood was plant a vineyard. So clearly wine holds a special part in our hearts.
It's also part of ritual and religion and so forth. But I have to give some props to a friend of mine named John DeLuca, who was, John, of course.
Of course.
Put things on the map. He was head of the Wine Institute for years, and he put things on the map as far as the healthy nature of wine. I mean, 60 Minutes did a big story and so forth. They're talking about how invigorating wine can be, how it's good for the heart and so forth. That really boosted sales enormously.
Yeah.
And then he also got into all this indigenous sense of, you know, we celebrate our heritage and tradition, if we come from Italy or France or wherever we come from in Europe or even other continents, wine has always played a central role.
You're right. I mean, one of the things I write about in Tangled Vines is how California wine was not broadly accepted around the world really until, you know, the 20th century. I mean, the early days of making wine in California brought out, you know, people who were just out there to make a buck, and they didn't really care about the wine they made, and they used terrible processing methods. They adulterated the wine. They put in dye to make it redder. And this wine was then sold in bulk to New York and New Orleans. The restaurateur would put these wines in bottles. And if it was bad wine, they would label it as California wine. And if it was good California wine, they would label it as French wine. So for a very, very long time, California wine got no respect at all. And it really wasn't until something called the California Wine Association, which is another very interesting dark chapter of California history, that wine was broadly accepted throughout the United States.
We're talking again, if you've just joined us, with Frances Dinkel-Spiel, and her book is called Tangled Vines, the subtitle Greed, Murder, Obsession, and an Arsonist in the Vineyards of California. I want to bring you, our listeners, into this discussion, talking really more broadly about wine itself and its effect on you and, the history of the wine industry. And many of you probably remember, of course, that episode that takes a central role in Frances's book involving Mark Anderson and the burning down of his own storage place. But we do invite your involvement in the program, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. That number, 866-733-6786. Please feel free to call us. Again, toll-free number, questions or comments, or joining the conversation, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Many ways you can communicate. We do want to hear from you, so feel free to join us. Frances Dinkel-Spiel is co-founder of BerkeleySide.com. We'll maybe find out a little bit more about that in the course of this hour and some other things that really are fascinating in this book. The book, again, is Tangled Vines. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the dark history of California's wine industry, which is exposed in Tangled Vines, a book by Frances Dinkel-Spiel. And she is co-founder of BerkeleySide.com and also the author of Towers of Gold. And Tina just reminded me that Karen McNeil was on Friday with Rachel Morrow hosting, talking about her book, The Wine Bible. Forum is not necessarily becoming obsessed with wine, never fear. But it does play a very prominent role in California history, as we've been saying. In fact, you were talking about, Frances, the fact that many respects California felt kind of ignored for quite some time. But there are other parts of California that, I mean, It started in Southern California, then it shifted up here, and then Santa Barbara tried to get itself on the map, you know, in terms of being a major wine producer, and felt, you know, they were kind of overshadowed by Napa and Sonoma. There's been all this regional stuff going on.
Well, absolutely. I think there are, you know, vineyards in almost every county in California, and there were vineyards in a lot of counties, you know, back in the 19th century. But, you know, Napa has so dominated the script of the California wine business for years that other regions have felt slighted. But Santa Barbara produces some fantastic wine, and that movie Sideways really put it on the map. And, of course, Sonoma is, you know, a great wine region, and practically almost any other county makes some great wine in California.
Sideways had a lot of effect on Merlot, too, if you remember the movie. I want to get to our callers. And by the way, you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. I want to ask you, though, about you had this 93-year-old wine cooped up, actually 140-year-old wine, but it was cooped up, and this is part of the Mark Anderson wine in terms of his what he had in storage out there. And here's this port. Tell this story. I mean, you're with this guy, Fred Dame.
Right. So this was one of the questions I had in writing Tangled Vines. All of this family's old wine burnt up. But what did it matter? I mean, wine is meant to be consumed. It's only a liquid. I was wondering, what did I lose when this wine was destroyed? And I had one bottle of port left that I had been given, that my stepmother had given me. And I really wanted to know if it was any good. And I met this man named Fred Dame, who is a master sommelier. He is one of the most knowledgeable men about wine in the world. This is a very, very difficult test to get your sommelier credential. Most people study for years and have to take the test multiple times. Fred, who lives in South San Francisco, took it one time and passed. He is one of 15 people in the world who passed on the first try. So I met Fred through the course of doing this book, and I asked him if he would taste my wine. And Fred is a very, very, very busy man, and he kept putting me off. But I'm a very, very, very persistent reporter, and I finally got Fred to agree to come and try my wine. So I went to his house in Southern California, and he was about to get on a plane to go somewhere. And he greeted me, and it was clear he was in a hurry. But Fred is also a teacher, and he couldn't help himself. He knew he had to help me in this book. So we went upstairs to his house, and Fred took this bottle of port that I had brought, and he opened it up. And as soon as he popped the cork out of the bottle, these amazing fumes filled the kitchen. And it was just extraordinary. I was like 4 feet away, and I could smell this port right away. And Fred poured us two glasses, and then we went to his table to sit down and try the wine. And Fred took a sip. And his demeanor completely changed. He sort of went from being hurried and, you know, trying to get through this to relaxing and enjoying it. And he tasted the port and he said, "This is amazing port. You know, I know why it wasn't sold in 1875. It was set aside because it was very special port." And then we started to sort of settle into this lovely conversation and really enjoy one another and appreciate this port. And for me, that was a very important moment because it showed what wine can do at its best. You know, wine can bring people together. It can make them feel good. It makes the conversation flow. It really can unite people.
And again, there's that word aphrodisiacal here, too. Can get the hormones going?
Absolutely. So anyway, that was quite a wonderful moment. And luckily, I had a lot left over, so I got to share it with my friends.
Well, it reminds me, you know the story by Edgar Allan Poe, the Cask of Amontillado? You know, they go in these deep underground subterranean passages to get the Amontillado. And let me go to our callers here, and let's bring in a caller from Vallejo. Stan, you're on. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My name is Don, not Stan.
But... Oh, sorry.
And I live up on a hill overlooking Mare Island, and I watch that fire. And I watch all the fires on Mare Island. But this one in particular, what interested me was, like, later in the evening, there were a lot of flatbed trucks pulling up to the warehouse, what was left of it. And they left as it was getting dark, and it was just full of big, huge containers. And I assumed it was – I thought they were supposed to inspect the wine before they allowed that to happen and when a fire like that occurred.
I think they are supposed to inspect the wine. I mean, most vintners don't want to let wine that has been tainted by smoke get out on the market under their own labels. But, you know, maybe there were some people who felt like their wine had not been burned and they wanted to get it out there before the authorities, you know, put a clamp down on it. I don't know about that, but I can imagine that might have been what happened.
And thank you, Dan. We go right to another caller, and that's Richard. Richard, join us.
Hi, I really enjoy your talk on the wine here. And I was sort of wondering, although you're focused on California wine, if you're familiar with similar scandals in other parts of the world. And I remember going to Italy around 2005 or something and buying some Brunello, which, of course, is a wine that can only be grown in a certain small area in Montalcino. And having heard at the time that there had been this scandal a couple of years earlier where there was lots of fake Brunello on the market, you know, wine with that label, but not from that area. And then just again last year, the Italian police raided 160,000 cases of fake Brunello. And that's not an expensive wine. It sells for maybe like $40 there and maybe $100 here. But do you know whether any of the fake Brunello ever got to the States?
Well, no, I don't know about that particular case, but there are many cases in Europe of people falsifying what kind of wine is going into bottles. With Brunello, with French wine, you know, there were even some famous cases of someone putting antifreeze in wine to make it sweeter. Whew. I mean, there is a lot of fraud going on and, you know, throughout the world.
Thank you for the call. About, what, $25 billion industry as the crow flies?
In California.
Yeah, just in California itself. Go to more of your calls. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Timothy, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, Francis. It's said anecdotally that the Chinese grape wine producers are producing more now than the United States. And not only that, there is further anecdotal evidence that there is a big presence of China capital owning grape producing regions in California, but you never see on a good bottle of wine or a lesser quality bottle of wine any kind of labeling that indicates China grape material used or China wine. Shouldn't there be truth in labeling? If wine is coming from China in the bottle, shouldn't the buyer of that bottle know this is China wine they're drinking?
To be, say, made in China, although that sounds like the old novelties, but the problem, I suppose, from some concerns would be people see things made in China and they're worried it may be toxics and, you know, things get by in China that shouldn't get by. There's so many cases of that, particularly pet food and the like.
Well, that may be true, but the Chinese wine industry is really growing, and they are producing some very good wines in China. I mean, I don't know about how much is being imported in the United States. I can imagine it's not that much. The Chinese appetite for wine has also grown in the last couple decades. And in fact, you know, people who live in Hong Kong went crazy for auction wine after the tax laws were changed, and they are really responsible for driving up the price of wine, you know, in throughout the world. And the Chinese, of course, are buying up a lot of the Bordeaux in France. Like, there is a lot of Chinese capital.
So buying a lot of property, by the way, too,
right,
here in San Francisco.
Right.
But you don't know about the labeling. I mean, that
I don't know about the labeling.
That's what the caller wanted
but
to know.
But I know in California, the labeling laws are very, very strict.
It's expanding everywhere, really. I mean, because wine is expanding. Have you looked at numbers recently? I mean, they keep going up and up and up, don't they, in terms of consumers?
Well, the United States is now the single largest consumer per capita of wine in the world, and that's a change. And France, the consumption of wine was going down, and people there were very worried, but I guess it's gone up again in the last year or so.
You don't have to worry about the French and wine, I think. It will stabilize somehow. Frances Dinkelspiel with us, her book, Tangled Vines, and your calls. San Bruno, Rick, you're on.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Good morning to you, enjoying the conversation. Hey, I used to be in the wine industry for many years as a salesperson and a sales manager. A quick little story that would have been a little tidbit for her book. I was working for a big distributor and was recruited by a new winery up in Napa called Joseph Matthews Winery, and I went to visit them, and they had brand new facilities, brand new restaurant, and they asked me to be their salesperson for the Bay Area, and I happily decided to do that. And come to find out after a few months working with them and placing their wine in several nice restaurants in some markets down here in San Francisco in the peninsula, that they were a front for money laundering.
I wish I'd known about this.
And of course, I lost my job, which I was very upset, having a young son and one on the way, and actually was fortunate to go back to work for a distributor again. This was back in the 1980s, and
That's very interesting that it's a money laundering front, because a lot of people say the quickest way, of course, to become a millionaire is to start out as a billionaire and buy wine, buy land in Napa. So that's kind of funny that they were using it to launder money.
And thank you, Rick, for that call. Good to hear from you. We're hearing from some listeners by email. One listener writes, did your guest do any further investigation into the deaths of Ernest and Julio Gallo's parents? Of Blood and Wine suggests this was a very suspicious set of circumstances.
No, I didn't. That book, Blood and Wine, is a very good one, but no, I didn't look into the deaths of the Gallos.
This has nothing to do with the Gallos, but there, I was up in Napa not too long ago, and I was told by someone who knows about these things that a lot of the scions of some of the more prominent wine industry people are either in rehab or right out of rehab. Do we know anything about those kind of statistics? I mean, how this legacy of, well, for example, addiction to alcohol maybe, or narcotics maybe integral somehow to the wine industry?
Well, I'm just sort of speaking off the top of my head. I imagine, yeah, when you are around wine a lot and you drink wine a lot and you're trying to sell wine, I mean, you can overindulge. And I'm sure it's an issue for people up there. But I don't have any statistics. That could have been another sort of dark side of the wine.
Yeah, we get into all these dark sides here. And here's an email. Francis, it's your distant cousin Conrad. Question. Did you investigate Lachman and Jacoby, wine and brandy distributors at First and Market around 1890 through Prohibition? Was our family bootlegging?
So Lachman and Jacoby was a wine house in San Francisco. This was another fun tidbit I found out about, that the center of the wine business around the turn of the century was San Francisco, because the way wine was sold was very different than it is now. People, winemakers would grow grapes and make wine and then sell their wine to these huge wine houses, which would put them in these enormous barrels and then distribute the wine throughout the United States. And there were about 100 wine houses around 1900 in San Francisco. And Lachman and Jacoby was one of the biggest. And I am a descendant of the Jacoby side of that family. Lachman and Jacoby, I think they were pretty much out of business after Prohibition. So no, alas, there's no good stories about bootlegging from them. But there are lots of great stories about bootlegging up in Napa. It certainly flourished during Prohibition. And there's a great book called When the Rivers Ran Red about Sonoma and Prohibition that I highly recommend.
You've certainly done a prodigious amount of research. Kudos on that score. Here's another listener who writes, this doesn't get much discussion, but I'd like your guest's opinion on the frequency of wine doctoring by the winemaker to add additional flavors that are desirable, like spices or color, like mega purple. You alluded to this a little bit before.
So the vast majority of wine that's produced in California are kind of lower level or lower costing bottles of wine, you know, under $15, under $10. And people don't want to spend a lot of money for wine. And so these wines are made on an industrial level. And in order to enhance the flavor of these less expensive wines, winemakers do take certain things, like adding oak chips to make the wine taste oakier. I don't know if they're adding like purple additives, but they may be. And this is all because they're trying to produce a decent quality bottle of wine for under $10. And if you're really concerned about that, I just suggest you buy more expensive wine where you're not going to see that happening.
Here's Joseph, who writes, my father, Clem Stein, he passed away, was a small investor at Rosenblum in Alameda when it was still closely held. And I finally remember the family-style annual meetings at the winery, complete with sit-down dinners and, of course, plenty of product. The wine industry, I learned, is almost an affair of the heart and passion more than anything else. And like passion, it can be extremely volatile financially as well, both in good and bad way.
Can I just respond to that?
Sure,
of course. That's you know, there's so many great stories of family drama. I mean, I suggest the book The House of Mondavi by Julia Flynn Seiler to talk about the passions that united the Mondavis and then thrust them apart. I mean, there are all these great stories of wine families doing great things and then sort of imploding because of the intensity of the business.
Let me go to our callers, and let's go to San Rafael. Ken, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Michael. Thank you. Francis, I just want to acknowledge you for, in telling the story about the Vallejo fire, really focusing on the family winemakers, you know, a lot of them that were hurt, you know, badly during that whole experience. And like a lot of people, you know, I've been drinking wine for many years, and I've always bought wine, you know, retail or through shops, you know, in the city or something like that. But I started to get educated through a good friend of mine, John Hinman, who's a preeminent wine attorney in San Francisco, about the fact that when you support family winemakers and you're bypassing that wholesale system, where if they have to sell their wines to a wholesaler, you know, that takes a lot of the profit out of it for them. So I've started to really join these wine clubs, you know, the local wineries that I like, especially, you know, a lot of the Russian River Pinot winemakers who make some great wines up there. But by joining the wine clubs directly, what you're doing is you're really supporting these local winemakers who are making less than 20,000 cases a year and are making really custom-crafted wines. And if you really want to keep that legacy alive in Northern California here, in my mind, that's the way to do it.
All right. Ken, we'll let that stand, and we thank you for the call. We're going to go right to another caller, and that's Robert in Hillsburg. Morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm actually a Pinot Noir grower, not a winemaker, but I'm a grower. And love Francis's first book, in part because my great-great-grandfather was a minor character in the book down in Los Angeles. And I'm wondering about my great-great-uncle, L.J. Rose of Sunny Slope Vineyard, and if Sunny Slope figures at all into this somewhat dark history of wine in California.
Well, of course, I know about Sunny Slope Vineyards, and it was a big winemaking operation in the San Gabriel Valley. It was a very important one, and it was also important because in the 1880s, when phylloxera devastated France, a lot of people thought, well, California wine was going to replace French wine. And a lot of rich people got into the business, like Leland Stanford and George Hurst. And a lot of British investors came over, and most of them invested money in Sunny Slope, L.J. Rose's operation. And unfortunately, a terrible disease called Pierce's disease soon ripped through that area and destroyed all the vineyards, including Sunny Slope. And those poor British investors were wiped out. So no, I'm sorry that I don't focus on his winery, but I certainly know about it. And it was very big winery and an important winery in California history.
And we thank you for the call. You know, in the midst of writing this book and the last book, Towers of Gold, you've been doing this Berkeley side as well. And that's a journalistic enterprise, isn't it? What are you doing in that?
Well, Berkeleyside is an online news site focused on the city of Berkeley. And we also have an ancillary site called Nosh, which is a food site focused on the East Bay. And two friends and I started Berkeleyside about 6 years ago because we were concerned about the decline in local news because of the cutbacks in the various newspapers. And so we've been doing it since then. And it's a 24/7 endeavor. There's so much news in Berkeley. But we write about like lots of aspects of Berkeley every day, from covering city council meetings to writing about, very interesting authors and poets, to writing about, you know, the pier being closed. So it's our attempt to sort of keep, you know, local news flourishing.
Let me go to more calls. We'll keep our calls flourishing and we'll go to Calistoga. Ken, you're on. Morning.
Yes, good morning. We have a small winery here, family-owned winery in Calistoga. And been approached by a couple of Chinese investors to buy our winery and our stock. It's kind of interesting. We declined, of course. And I've just seen that a bit more, that there's a lot of international interest in this area. And I think that, I don't know if you mentioned it, but the movie Bottle Shock You mentioned Sideways, but that put this whole area on the map. The event that happened in 1976, you're familiar with it, right?
I'm familiar with The Judgment of Paris, and of course I saw the movie Bottle Shock, which I thought was a great movie.
It was very well, even though a bit of fiction in there, but it was well done. And another thing, you know, one reason why I really think that family-owned wineries that don't produce more than 20,000 cases can produce a really stellar product is that you have the whole thing quantity versus quality, and that the economy of scale. As you go on up, there's a lot of stuff that you tend to miss. A lot more attention can be put towards the process, the selection, making sure you don't include a lot of leaves and other materials in there. More hands-on ability from a smaller source than a large scale where they just smash on through the grapes and you're getting something that doesn't quite have the same, the same amount of care. So those are things that I think are really of concern to me. I don't want to see people all of a sudden this whole area become big corporations. I see that there's a lot of wineries being bought up by different conglomerates, and all of a sudden small family winery that I knew disappeared.
Well, one of the things that makes it difficult now, Ken, and appreciate your calling in, is the drought. I mean, there's been a lot of suffering in the wine industry in the drought, so when international bankroll comes in, it's tempting, especially to small farming vintners, wouldn't you say, Francis?
Well, I think Napa still has a majority. The Napa Valley Vintners Association says that the majority of its members are small, family-owned operations. And I think that's still the majority in Napa. But there are a number of large, groups like Constellation, which bought up Robert Mondavi, that are operating as well. And it will be interesting to see if there is more Chinese money coming in. There is another book called Thirsty Dragon, which writes about the Chinese money taking over Bordeaux. But I don't think there's been a similar, interest of the Chinese in Napa or Sonoma counties, but maybe there will be in the future. It'll be an interesting thing to watch.
Here's Zach. Zach, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Good morning, Michael. Good morning, Francis. Boy, what an interesting conversation. Wanted to ask your advice on wine selection. Usually my method in the grocery store is looking at price point within my range and an interesting-looking label, and if I'm lucky, flavor notes that are on the label. But otherwise, I wonder if you have any advice on a less haphazard method of selecting wine.
Yeah, the first thing I would suggest is don't buy your wine at a grocery store. You should go find a small wine shop in your neighborhood and go in there and tell them sort of what kind of wine you like. And if you go back repeatedly, those people in the wine store will soon get to know your taste and they'll soon be able to suggest wine for you. And I think that's probably the best way to first of all, discover what you really like and get some great recommendations, because there's, these people know their wines in the store and they can really talk to you about it. I mean, Safeway now has amazing selection of wines and they're very, very affordable, but there are not people there who are going to tell you exactly what they taste like a wine store can.
And let me thank you for the call, Zach. How much wine do you drink, Francis?
Probably too much. No, I like to drink wine at night.
Always with dinner or usually with dinner?
No, I like to, when I cook, I like to drink a glass of wine. I actually like drinking wine before I eat my dinner, probably more than drinking it with dinner.
And do you cook a lot with wine?
With wine? You mean cook a lot while drinking it?
No. I mean, use wine in your recipes.
Occasionally,
just interested. We were interested in hearing what more callers have to say. This is Conrad. Is this a distant cousin, Conrad? Conrad?
Yeah.
Are you the distant cousin, Conrad? No. Okay.
Conrad with a K.
Okay. Go ahead. You're on.
I just had a couple of questions about your thoughts on, in terms of the production capacity and stuff of a lot of the wineries in the north versus the south. Of course, I guess I'm referring to Napa, Sonoma, Russia River area versus the Central Valley. Because I know that I find it, from my point of view, it looks kind of like a vicious cycle in that we can – the production ability and what they can invest into their acreage up north is totally different from what they can do down south, because there's a perception that oh, this is better wine, so we can sell it for a higher price, whereas in the South, it's kind of the other way around. And then you get Gallo. You know, they do use additives and oak chips and those types of things, but that's because no one's going to, if everyone looks on the back of the bottle and it says made in Modesto, they're like, oh, that's Gallo. And there's kind of a negative reputation with it. So just kind of some of your thoughts on that.
So the vast majority of wine made in California does come from the Central Valley, and it is sold at, you know, $10 or so for a bottle. Gallo is the largest winemaking operation in the world, and it does mostly make this lower price wine, which, you know, we all preferred until, you know, the 1970s. Gallo, of course, does make some very good quality wine. They've started to make, you know, wine in Napa and other places around California. I'm not exactly sure what your question is. You know, by and large, the wine that does come from the Central Valley isn't as good as the wine that is made in Napa and Sonoma and Amador and other counties, because as one of the earlier callers pointed out, those are mostly smaller operations, and they're really trying to maximize their vineyards, and they're paying a lot of attention to the grapes that they do have or the grapes that they buy.
And let me thank Conrad for the call. Sorry to say we are out of time here, but a good place to go out here is with a listener comment in an email here who writes, regarding the first legislation passed by the state of California, I learned from the book Factories in the Fields how waves of immigration have fed the Central Valley's need for harvest labor and the system that has grown and supported. Indeed, we pretty much brought that to light here as well. Lots brought to light. Thanks to you. Appreciate your being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Again, Francis Nicholspiel's book is Tangled Vines, Greed, Murder, Obsession, and an Arsonist in the Vineyards of California. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org. And you can also let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Natalie Yemenijan. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Interns Latoya Tools and Jeremy Siegel, and for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.